In case you haven't heard, it's officially an Abercrombie summer. The A&F Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the A&F Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
Brace the rudders! Raise the sails! Raise the sails!
Captain, an unidentified ship is approaching. Over.
Roger. Wait, is that an Enterprise sales solution?
Reach sales professionals, not professional sailors. With LinkedIn ads, you can target the right people by industry, job title, and more. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Get started today at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail. Companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Evan Yuk, co-founder and CEO of User Evidence.
What we're trying to do is, you know, introduce some truth or scientific rigor or data-driven approach to helping buyers assess the value that a vendor is delivering. It's interesting, like, I'd argue that the stakes are getting a little bit higher today where, you know, there is a big cost if you get something wrong. Like, without infinite budgets now and infinite VC funding, like, you kind of got to get it right.
This is Evan. His journey in the tech industry is a testament for his entrepreneurial spirit and sales acumen. He started his career as an SDR in 2010, joining Tech Validate as their first sales employee. This early experience laid the foundation for his future success. What's remarkable about Evan's career trajectory is how he rapidly climbed the ranks in sales leadership. At Tech Validate, he built and managed the sales organization, growing it to a 50-person team. His success in this role led to Tech Validate's acquisition by SurveyMonkey in 2015, where Evan continued to excel in enterprise sales leadership positions. Despite his success in larger companies, Evan's passion for early-stage startups led him to co-found User Evidence in August 2020. This move was inspired by his first-hand experience of the pain points in B2B sales and marketing, particularly in the challenge of creating and leveraging customer stories at scale. And their mission? Helping quality software vendors with satisfied customers stand out in a noisy marketplace. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Evan to my podcast. We explore how the process of collecting quality customer evidence is still broken. Evan explains how they're approaching the problem in a way that was unthinkable before. He shares strategies for cutting through the intense market noise today. And last but not least, he elaborates on his lessons learned from building successful sales teams from the ground up with junior talent. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, what's working well for User Evidence's own growth and pipeline generation when it comes to reaching the right buyer via outbound. Secondly, why Evan is deliberately choosing to organize his business around sales-led growth and not product-led growth. Thirdly, what non-obvious opportunities many companies have when they centralize and democratize customer feedback across customer functions. And lastly, why he'd focus on more durable categories like vertical SaaS over crowded go-to-market tools if he'd had the chance next time. Hi, Evan. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Don. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it's been a while. When I got introduced to you again, it was like, wait a minute, I know this guy. And it appeared that's about, I think, 12, 13 years ago.
You have a recognizable name, so like it stood out to me. So yeah, the story, I started my career as an SDR. It was my first job out of college in 2010. And so I was just ripping cold calls and stuff like that. And yeah, I remember you're the VP of marketing at Unit 4, I believe. And I was trying to get in touch and, you know, cold call and email and LinkedIn and whatever else we had. But yeah, I think we did end up getting you on an intro call back in the day.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So it worked. And it was intriguing back then. I think it's even more intriguing what you're doing right now, because it's the same theme, but now on steroids with the technology that's available today. So eager to have you on the call. Also, because passion-wise, we very much believe in the same thing. You know, companies sell more effective when you let your customers do the talking. I mean, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, which is, all about that. So that was another reason to get you on the call to see what technology can do here.
It's gotten cooler, that's for sure. Yeah, it's, the tool set available today is just so powerful, especially applied to this problem. So yeah, it's interesting.
Exactly. So before we start talking about your company, User Evidence, you know, what better name to have, because it explains exactly what your company is all about.
And the domain was only $11 per year, so it worked out.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm amazed it was still available. But first of all, about you, what drives you? What do you get energy from?
Yeah, I've found over the years I'm a pretty like intellectually motivated person. So I really enjoy, you know, the building, especially like early stage is so fun for me because it's so creative and messy. And, it lends itself well to just experimentation and having to figure it out on the fly. And I love those sort of just like thorny, heady, intellectual problems that are difficult, but require like just some creative thought. And for me, that's awesome. Like I remember when I was graduating from college, I was an econ major at Stanford. And like the cool thing to do at the time was to go do like finance and consulting for, JP Morgan and Bain and all those things. And it was just such like linear hard work. Like all the kids in my class were just way smarter than me at this one thing, doing analysis and spreadsheets and working super hard. And I was I wasn't particularly good at anything, but I was good at a range of different things, which lent itself well to early stage, just figure it out startups. Yeah. But it was my first job as the first salesperson at this company, Tech Validate. We got to do anything from, RevOps to figuring out how to do email blasts to figuring out how to sell to cold calls. So that sort of like diverse range of stuff was super motivating for me and still is. Like, since then I've become more motivated by building and leading teams too and just developing and coaching people, but I still love the science tinkering side to it for sure.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, once you start understanding your strength and where you deliver your best work and get most energy from, then amplifying that is the way to go. So kudos for you that you found it and that you found your spot. Because otherwise you can be pretty miserable in a job.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. I mean, the goal, or not the goal necessarily, but one of the goals for an early stage startup is, you hope you build a good company and you have some sort of liquidation event, right? If you're huge, you can IPO, but that's pretty rare. Most of them, like a good outcome is getting acquired. And so your goal is to eventually join a bigger company. And then you go to this bigger company and you do your two-year tour of duty. I think at the height of it, I was running global enterprise sales for SurveyMonkey and had like 140 people on my team, and I'd have to stand up there on stage and give a speech and stuff like that. And that was about, that was about the upper limit. I wasn't very good at that. And so, being back in early stage is great and comfortable for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's good to have, the experiences from the different angles. At some point, it brings you to the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the fantastic bridge to your new company. I mean, I know what the company does because I also know your history at, Validate, but you started the company in 2020. What was the problem that you saw, that you still saw at the end, that was screaming for a solution?
Yeah, I mean, you've been a VP of marketing for an enterprise software company, so you'll understand this. I was mostly for my career, the sales side. So leading, as an enterprise rep and leading enterprise sales teams. And, that dynamic was always interesting between sales and marketing, right? Like, I saw this marketing often over-indexed on these kind of like big brand-oriented customer stories. Like SurveyMonkey is a good example. Like we spent, you know, probably millions of dollars with some creative brand agency. And you know, from that, we had three or four like of the most beautiful, cool case studies with the coolest companies in the world. Like here's how, you know, Warby Parker does this, this, and this. But as an enterprise rep, we had like five different products to sell across 17 different industries in three regions. And so we would get questions like, you know, hey, I'm a, you know, a retail company, you know, in EMEA, and I want to see how this product works as a replacement to this incumbent that I have. And I was like, well, have you seen the Warby Parker case study? And so we never had the depth and breadth and specificity, which, you know, as an enterprise salesperson, like that was key for building credibility. If you're selling something expensive, you know, especially in this market where there's a decent amount of like rigor and kind of conservatism when it comes to buying stuff now, like buyers want to have a feel very confident that the vendor they're choosing is going to deliver results and ROI for uniquely them, meaning like same industry, same use case, same problem, same size. But the problem is if you're selling to 17 different industries and five different products and, you know, three different regions, then you need 1700 permutations of unique stories to get these exact matches. And we, like, even though we had three beautiful case studies, it didn't help me communicate and prove to my prospect that, you know, we have a bunch of experience and you know, dedicated evidence in their space. That makes sense?
Totally. Which was exactly also why we talked back then, 12 years ago, because it always comes down to, okay, these five or six case studies that everybody knows. And yeah, like you say, it's good, but at some point it's okay. It's not good enough anymore.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's table stakes, right? It's like,
exactly. You need to go down to problem level. You need to go down to use case, to situation, to, I mean, all the dice, slicing and dicing.
Yeah. And particularly today, like I think the big theme that we're seeing is like, there's so much pressure. Like now that like CFOs are getting more involved and there's more pressure to have like a concrete financial narrative, like actual credible, believable data and like statistical evidence around ROI and time savings and productivity gains so that people can come back to their CFO with a case on how this thing's going to deliver return on investment, you know, in a reasonable time frame. So that, yeah, the insight was like, it's weird. Like, you know, the vendors I see, Gong, Salesforce, you know, Coupa, they have thousands or tens of thousands of customers, yet they only tell stories from, you know, 1% of them, right? And so the question was, how could we kind of democratize or harness the voice of these oftentimes very large customer base to create robust, you know, statistically significant, you know, substantive proof and evidence that would make an overwhelming, obvious case to a prospect that this is, you know, a smart decision.
Okay, got a load of questions around this. So I understand what's the opportunity if you get this right. You just explained the pain on the sales side, which I think is also pain on the marketing side. But okay, so, I mean, there was already something out there that tried to kind of nail that problem, tech validate in this case, and still you decided to do something else. And of course, I think in the space, I know a couple of others that are doing the same thing. It must be in the marketing and sales automation space, there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of players out
there.
So what have you done deliberately differently in order to stand out from the start?
Yeah, I mean, that the space has evolved, you know, so... Yeah, just the kind of timeline. I mean, it used to be just, you know, you'd have like a customer reference team was called back in the day that would just like try to get references and then do some case studies. And then there's always been, you know, a good amount of spend and focus with analyst firms like Gartner and Forrester to get, you know, third-party validation, which was kind of the other thing we were going after. And then, yeah, over time, like, you know, the emergence of peer review sites was really interesting. So like G2 and there's a bunch of others. And then, yeah, to your point, you know, broadly, just there's so much go-to-market tech now. It's just so freaking noisy. But honestly, that's, you know, part of the problem that we're trying to solve. Like some of these spaces, there's, you know, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting five dozen vendors that kind of all sound the same and do the same thing. And vendors all just throw claims out wildly around, you know, hey, we're going to make you more productive and better and faster and stronger. And again, it sounds like noise and just kind of gets bled out. And so part of what we're trying to do is, you know, introduce some truth or scientific rigor or data-driven approach to helping buyers assess the value that a vendor is delivering. It's interesting, like, if you look at how B2B buyers make decisions, if you look at when stuff is actually important to us, like if Airbus needs to make a plane that flies, we're going to bring some people that are smart. We're going to do some tests. We're going to have a hypothesis. We're going to have a lot of data behind it. When we go to make a B2B purchase, we're like, it's kind of, you know, let's look at some demos. Like, we'll talk to a reference or two, and, you know, we'll just look at a Gartner report, and that's kind of it. And yeah, granted, the stakes are obviously much lower in that case, but I'd argue that the stakes are getting a little bit higher today, where, you know, there is a big cost if you get something wrong. Like, you know, that can be your job. That can be, you know, just without infinite budgets now and infinite VC funding, like, you kind of got to get it right. So I think there's just so much room for a lot more rigor in how buyers kind of sift through all this noise and start to divine, you know, who is the right vendor for them. So I think that the biggest differentiator is probably, if you had to summarize it, is like going from individual stories, just here's a case study, here's a testimonial, to here's 4,000 data points from, you know, people in your industry, and here's how they've been able to achieve these outcomes.
Let me make a small interruption here. Even just made an excellent remark that provides the foundation for durable differentiation. Instead of trying to make the traditional approach creating top-down corporate testimonials easier, they focused on introducing a bottoms-up approach that captures thousands of evidence points. This not only reduces the barriers to capture evidence, it also allows for much more detailed roll-ups, slicing and dicing, and relevance presentation, which builds trust. Besides that, it feeds every function in the business to learn and improve. That's a trait remarkable software companies master. They focus on the essence, create new value possibilities, and leverage that to surprise and hit the right nerve. You can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. Wow. That's a totally different thing. Which brings, I mean, having been responsible for this myself, and, you know, being already happy that at some point when customers say, yeah, you know, I'd like to kind of share something with you, but you're talking about 4,000 data points. How do you get those customers, and how can technology help there to get customers to talk beyond the obvious? I mean, I see so many of those case studies, like, yeah, it was really nice to work with them, and the project was delivered on time.
Totally,
so what?
Some of these milk toast vanilla, like, yeah, they're a great partner.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's, I think one of the evolutions of software that kind of led us to some of these insights, like, is that software is often so widely deployed now in an organization. If you think of like a developer tool or a CRM or a project management tool, you know, you're not just selling to one person, right? Your footprint at an account might be hundreds of users across different personas and levels within an account. So I think part of the way you kind of tell this broader story around how you're having an impact across, you know, hundreds or thousands of people is capturing feedback at that sort of one-to-many scale, right? The traditional approach is like, you know, hey, can you do a case study? Can you do a case study? And you go to your champion.
True.
I think our more modern and sophisticated customers, the way they collect data is now a lot more scaled and programmatic. So in addition to just one-to-one asks, you know, of course it might be email blast, but even more advanced than that, you know, popping up pop-ups in app, you know, if you're trying to get evidence around how much time a feature saved, the right time to ask that question is right after they use that feature, not 9 months later, right? Triggering of surveys at logical points in the customer journey, like post onboarding, close won, close loss, because that happens every day. And so, yeah, if you can get this more automated one-to-many reach across different channels that hits more of both the kind of economic buyer, but also the aggregate users in that account. And that's kind of why I chose the name user evidence, is because, you know, I saw decision-making happening more, especially with product-led growth, happening in a more bottoms-up way, where it's not just one person making the decision. Often it's there's already an engineering team using it, and then they bring in an economic buyer to close the deal, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's you make a good point about the whole trend around bottom-up. And even if it's not a bottom-up decision, because it was still enterprise software being sold, this is indeed how you can get access these days to users. People actually get benefit from it on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, indeed.
So, I mean, is there anything you've done here to also start then to connect the dots between, okay, what's being kind of said at the bottom level and how that adds up to to larger benefits and so on.
Yeah, I mean, that's where, you know, relative to the Tech Validate days 8 years ago, you know, that's where AI has been such a freaking boon, you know, to this problem, right? It's, you know, if you think about what it's good at, it's synthesizing large data sets to pull out the key salient themes, right? And so, you know, say you do a survey to, you know, 5,000 people or something like that, to be able to summarize themes in a particular industry. So say you want to create a report that is, you know, here's why financial services choose us. It's whatever, compliance and scalability, and here's the key outcomes. It's, you know, reducing total cost of ownership, you know, increasing compliance, whatever it is. You know, that is a very cool tool set applied to this problem. It also helps a lot on the distribution of that content. So back to the original problem I talked about as a salesperson, is like, hey, I need this specific thing, right? I need a, you know, medium-sized financial services company who's using private cloud and, you know, Azure, and they switch from AWS. And so the distribution with AI is really cool now, where instead of just like, you know, manually filtering and stuff like that, like we have a bot that you can just, that's like a content concierge. We can literally just ask that. It's like, you know, hey, I need this financial services customer in EMEA who switched from Azure. What do we got? It'll return relevant content, you know, on the fly in real time. So there's a bunch of different cool use cases for AI, all
for sure
benefiting from having this very much larger data source to then go draw upon.
Exactly. Yeah, it almost feels like that these days you can put it on autopilot, because the customer is evolving, the software knows where they are on their journey, and in come the various the data points. Do you also use it? I mean, of course you can use it in sales and marketing situations, but what I would expect also, now that I think about it, is that you also kind of play it back to the customer.
Yeah,
like, this totally is actually what you've achieved with our software.
So that is, you know, back to our market theme of like, hey, there's a lot more rigor around making sure that everything that we have is producing value. And people are trying to consolidate their tech stacks, you know, reduce tech spend, et cetera. And part of that is, you know, your existing vendors and making sure they're delivering value, right? So like a common motion for, you know, an enterprise account manager is to do these like quarterly business reviews, right? QBR, where you're like, hey, you know, basically here's where you started, and here's the delta in terms of the value that we've delivered over time. It does become more ongoing validation, right? That can be also be useful for retention and upsell and cross sell. It's also interesting, like if you think about the data source that we're using, it's, you know, it's essentially customer feedback, right? Empirical insights about, you know, the value or lack thereof that a customer has seen. Of course, interesting from an external perspective to present it as proof and evidence in the form of case studies and testimonials and cool stats. Yeah. But also very interesting for the company, for product management, customer experience. Yeah, I've seen some super interesting surveys where, you know, they might survey 5,000 users, and the marketers, of course, are just looking for the good stuff to turn into content. But when I looked at the data, there's these really interesting thematic, you know, potentially concerning trends around, you know, areas where people are frustrated with the experience, you know, account risk and churn risk and stuff like that. So it's the same data set, just a different lens. You know, there's an internal lens on what can we do better? How do we make a stickier product? Which gets in more into, you know, really insights and customer experience improvement and enterprise feedback management as well.
Fantastic way to align the company. What's really going on? Mm-hmm. Rather than trusting individuals and opinions and these type of things.
Completely agree with you.
So you started the business in 2020, middle of COVID. Mm-hmm. 4 years later now, what has been the hardest nut to crack to grow the adoption of the product?
Yeah, it's ironically the bigger problem that I want to solve. It is, we are also victim to the same issue that there's just so much freaking noise out there in the world that even if you have incredibly happy customers, like our net retention is over 130% this year, customers love it, but getting people on the damn phone is freaking hard still. It's like, cause the channels are bombed out, right? Like you get, you know, 95 emails a day. It doesn't matter what you're saying, even like, it's just, you know, they're not going to see it. And then even when you do get them on the phone, there's still so much, you know, skepticism and hesitance, right? Interesting research that we did primary, you know, in this more conservative market, people are kind of reverting back towards bigger bigger brands, right, that are just safer, right? So it's easier for an enterprise buyer to just be like, hey, these three vendors were in the top, you know, quadrant of the magic quadrant for Gartner. So they're obviously safe. Gartner's done the work to figure it out. And I don't have to do my work to really make this evaluation that interesting. So, you know, more emerging vendors have a much larger burden of proof to overcome this conservative brand advantage where they're just the default. But yeah, I mean, that's been the hardest thing for us is like, we're not in a defined category. So it's not like, it's a little bit tricky to market into that because there's not a bunch of existing demand to capture. So like we have to do a lot of, traditionally we've done a lot of outbound prospecting, and outbound prospecting has just gotten way freaking harder over the past, 7 or 8 years. You know, the good news is when we do land a client, we have a big Fortune 500 company that went from 25K to 350K within, 12 months. So the land and expand and the retention is fantastic. But yeah, new business is just a freaking slog. And that's, I'm an investor and advisor in quite a few early to mid-stage startups. And that's a problem everyone's feeling right now. It's just, it's hard to generate pipeline and win new deals.
You're not the only one saying this. Funny enough, I had Mark Kosoglow on the podcast.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For sure.
And he started his business April this year, early stage still. But I mean, he's openly admitting we blew it up. So now I'm gonna kind of be the first one to correct it. The great ago.
Yeah, but it's interesting. So yes, I was hanging out with them. We're both LPs in a fund called GTM Fund. So we were at the offsite in San Diego a couple months ago. But even with the most impressive, technically advanced setups, like our setups, and this is kind of what Operator does, it's like nuts, right? You have, predictive data providers and a whole bunch of demographic and firmographic signals and crap like that, wired up to Clay, that then's wired up to GPTs, but then goes and targets and stuff like that. And then you look at it, you're like, damn, this is freaking impressive. But it's still just incremental gains because the channel's bombed out. And so to me, there's a much more fundamental problem underneath this, which is we have a bad matching algorithm between a vendor with a solution and a company with a problem. And the reason why is because there's a bunch of imperfect information and noise in the middle, right? And so people don't know what to do. And our solution to the noise problem so far has been to yell louder. And now yell louder with AI in a slightly cooler way, but it's still the same thing. And I don't think it's solving the problem at all.
No, it's making it worse.
We're making it worse. Like 11X, for example, outreach and stuff like that. To me, it's just like, oh man, like why? There's so many smart people applied to this, such an inefficient method of gathering attention, which is just crazy to me. So that is something that I'm thinking about with this company is like, how do we improve this matching algorithm? So, and I think our starting point of, we have a ton of data and evidence around the value that vendors have delivered. Is that a way to go from imperfect information to slightly more perfect information such that you could reduce some of this noise and help buyers make better decisions? I think it's kind of analogous to, it is the role that Gartner and G2 play right now as these kind of independent third parties that essentially help buyers both discover and evaluate vendors, but it's not perfect. And I think there's room for disruption in that space. So that is something we're thinking about.
Yeah, it's interesting how these vendors gained any more important role again than they possibly had in the last couple of years, whereby everybody's now saying, okay, I give up on everything that's on the internet. I go back to you because you get paid tons of money.
Yeah, because you've done the work to synthesize it for me, right? Because there's so much noise out there that I can't make sense of it. And there's so many vendors that it's just like, it's impossible, right? Yeah. And just because our buying group has grown from 6 to 9 doesn't mean we're making better decisions. It just means we feel better about the decision because we're distributing the responsibility for it. It's not like you expect 9 people to evaluate 40 vendors and get a good outcome with a bunch of, steak dinner and golf games and stuff like that in the middle.
Yeah. And then, like you say, there's much more at stake as well these days. So all of these things don't help. So yeah, the question is, of course, how do you solve it? What has worked so far for you to get through the noise?
Yeah, ironically, I don't know if it's ironic or not, but content is working. So our best thing to generate calls this year, we did a longer format, like 20, 25 page original research report around this topic called the customer evidence gap, which basically means like there's a huge gap between what all the fantastic thing vendors claim that they can do and what these skeptical prospects believe. So we asked 200 buyers, 200 sellers, and 200 marketers questions about like what types of customer evidence they're looking for in today's evaluations. And it's really interesting to see the difference between those populations, right? Marketers thought that like big logos, right? Big case studies are, you know, what we need. And buyers are like, no, like we like analyst reports. Like we want statistical evidence. And so, yeah, the differences were cool. But anyway, that report did like incredibly well. I got like 2,000 downloads. Like we were aiming for 500 and generated a ton of pipeline. Granted, we had like a good distribution strategy around it. So like, in addition to just that survey data, we also, you know, got some in-depth interview content from like, you know, good buyers, like CIOs and stuff like that, great marketers, great salespeople to comment. And then we also use those people as the distribution engine to assist in the distribution, right? And so, yeah, the distribution was important, but that content, longer format content, I think is where, and that was a shift for us. Like before we were doing like a blog post every week, and now we're just like, all right, let's do the blog posts. Let's just do like one big rock content piece every quarter and like a big meaty, like actual high quality. Cause I think like there's such a low marginal cost now to just spitting out crappy content and blog posts and stuff like that, that there's just, you know, it's just no one cares anymore cause there's so much of it. So I think there's a reversion back to this big meaty long form content as like a really good way to get attention and cut through noise. Cause it's high quality in a sea of low quality crap.
It comes down to the perception from people. Okay, you spent quite a lot of time to bring this together.
Yeah.
And as such, it's worth my time. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think original research is just like, yeah, the kind of form that has been working that we see a lot of people do is this, you know, state of report, you know, 2025 state of AI and RevOps or data security or whatever it is. It's the, you know, essentially the B2C equivalent of like a top 10 listicle, right? Like top 10 hottest dudes in Hollywood or something like that. People are just going to read it all the time, right? And so it works. It's actually an offering that we've now productized. And so, you know, in addition to this customer evidence SaaS platform, where you can generate case studies and testimonials and stuff. If you think about what we're good at, it's turning survey data into good looking, you know, compelling content. And so another way to use that skill set is to point it at market research and prospects, right, that are not necessarily customers, so that from an earlier stage awareness perspective, you can start to establish authority around and thought leadership around the problem without necessarily saying, you know, hey, we're the best. And so, yeah, we productized that into a offering called user evidence research content. And that's selling really well because, again, these kind of big rock content pieces are working really well for, you know, PR and analyst relations and marketing communications and content and demand gen.
Yeah, exactly. Fascinating. But I mean, I also understand it. And I think that's maybe the way to go. It appears to be the way to go, which at the end also means lower volumes, but far higher quality. And at the end, quality always wins.
Yeah, I think that's necessary, right? Like where people are, we're aching for that, right? Just because we have so much out there. Ironically, the other thing that's kind of working. So email is not working at all. It's just disaster. Cold calls, still working. For how long, who knows, but which is shocking to me because I'd certainly never answer my phone if it's a number I don't know, but freaking VPs and marketers sometimes pick up the phone and, you know, we've gotten pretty good at turning those into intro calls. It's back to old school, right? It's long form, high quality content, cold calls. Who would have thought, right, in 2024?
Yeah. Well, it's, again, standing out. At some point, maybe direct marketing will come back, you know, sending physical things again. So
right, exactly. Yeah, totally.
Talking about that, from what I recall, because we talked on the phone, TechValidate was an organization that like sold these products through a sales motion. I for sure also know that SurveyMonkey has a motion like that. Do you envision that your company is going to be also primarily sales-led or is it more product-led?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, I think in our initial like VC pitch decks, you know, we had the, because PLG, especially 3 or 4 years ago, was like kind of a hot topic. You know, we had this PLG vision, right, where you could create a stripped down free or cheap, you know, testimonial collector, for instance, that, you know, hopefully you would acquire users in a larger organization, and then you could come in and sell the enterprise offering on top of that. I don't think we want to do that. I think that's hard. Like, TLD is tough, especially if you don't come from that background. Our background is, you know, enterprise sales. And so we have to lean into our enterprise sales skill set strength. So luckily we're, you know, we are, though it's hard as all heck today, we are still very good at enterprise prospecting. Our SDRs can get meetings with executives at bigger companies. And yeah, as we've started to increase the scope of the offering, and particularly now offering this kind of longer format analyst style content, which are these market research reports, but also like we have an ROI study that's basically a Forrester total economic impact report equivalent, and Forrester charges, you know, $150K for those TEIs. So now, like with a solution like that, we can charge, you know, 80 to 100K for a new business deal, and, you know, bigger accounts, you know, HP, Salesforce, Dell, Cisco, whatever, you know, can be $500,000 accounts. And so we really leaned into this. Our DNA is going to be, you know, mid-market to enterprise, you know, old school selling. Yes. And yeah, that's
nothing wrong with it. So that's good. So based on your experience there, because you built a sales team, Tech Validate, and later on, of course, you also, you just mentioned 140 people at SurveyMonkey. What strategies would you recommend to other SaaS founders who are looking to scale their sales operations?
Yeah, I mean, I think we had an incredibly unique founding team here, which is both of our founders started their careers as SDRs and worked their way up through the AEs and then sales leadership. And so we have a ton of just sales DNA, which is pretty rare. But I was having a conversation with the founder yesterday that I'm advising, who's a more technical oriented founder, and, you know, starting to get good product market fit. You know, his calendar's filled up. He's done a good job of founder selling. But I get a lot of questions around, like, you know, what should I look for my first VP of sales, right? And the error that I see, especially from a technical co-founder, is kind of like abdicating that sales responsibility way too early to someone they hope is just going to come in and have, you know, some magical superhuman silver bullet skill set. You know, the scary truth about sales is most of us, you know, aren't super smart. You know, we probably failed to get a technical background for a reason, right? We fell into sales. But yeah, I think founders should, like, they should be able to sell the product and figure out that early sales motion on their own. And then what I love is, like, when you can bring in your more junior people that are super early in their career, and then you can just teach them from the ground up. You know, that's what we did at Tech Validate. Obviously, like, you know, that was my first job out of college. You know, we've done that at User Evidence too. Like, our whole sales team, including leadership and all the senior account executives, all of them started as SDRs. And I think that's a great foundation. It's cool for a sales org too, because, like, when people come in, they see there's a demonstrated real path to advancement, because all the senior people were SDRs, you know, a couple of years ago, right? So that's my style, at least, you know. And I think for founders, should, you know, if you don't have a successful sales process on your own as a founder, you know, don't expect that you're going to bring in some sales leader and they're going to figure it out, right? It's like, you know, you have to figure out those early motions on your own.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe you like it or not. No, yeah. I think that's perfect advice, because yeah, indeed, why would you hire a VP of sales as your second person in the sales arena, where you could possibly deal with a couple of juniors who are eager?
Yeah, I mean, do you want someone that, you know, sits and talks about strategy all day, or does stuff? You know, I want someone that does stuff initially, and then through doing stuff, you will eventually become more strategic. That was kind of the big joke at Tech Validate when I interviewed there. I was like, you know, coming out of Stanford with my econ degree, I was like, what do you want to do? I was like, I want to do strategy. And everyone just kind of laughed at me. Like, all right, yeah, here's the 100 people, go cold call them. And you don't get to do strategy until you have enough experience where you kind of understand at a concept level, you know, the market dynamics and stuff like that. But that comes through just doing the stuff.
100% agree with that. And yeah, particularly, of course, for sales organizations that want to move from there, just take it step by step, and indeed, roll up your sleeves and go do it.
Yeah, for sure.
Since you are, you become, maybe you're one of the biggest experts in this whole domain of the customer voice and customer evidence, what are the trends that you're seeing right now? Also, given the fact that there is so much technology coming to the market so quickly right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like back in the day, you know, it was like, Tech Validate was its own thing that didn't really have a direct competitor for a long time, like basically its whole existence. Obviously, the review sites emerged in like 2014, 15. There's a couple like reference management platforms that just focused on facilitating references. And there was Synfluitive, which was its own little thing, which was this community kind of advocate engagement thing, which was cool. So now the space has gotten, there's a ton of new vendors. There's like, it's funny, there was a Forrester report that got released a couple of days ago that called us like, they're like, if you want a more mature, well-established option, you should look at User Evidence, which is hilarious as a three-year-old, 30-person company. I'm like, oh, we're the mature option now. I was like, I'll take it. There's a ton of early stage startups, which is, I think, great to see. So that there's a lot of just smart people and innovation coming into the space. I'm always a little concerned when I see them enter, because it's just like, the reality is like customer marketing is growing, but it's not like, you see very few VPs of customer marketing, put it that way, right? You know, in a bigger function, product marketing, you know, even enablement, you know, like there's VPs and there's vendors that do hundreds of millions of dollars in enablement. You have Seismic and, you know, HighSpot and stuff like that. Yeah. So I do think customer marketing still has some work to do to get a seat at this executive revenue table and actually get like leadership representation versus just reporting in through product marketing or through marketing communications or brand or wherever they come from. But I think we'll get there. You know, if you look at customer success as an example, like, you know, that was kind of a downtrodden, you know, second class function for a long time, right? And then it kind of came more into vogue and you saw a vendor ecosystem pop up around it with, you know, Gainsight and Tatango and Planet and all this stuff. And now it's a, you know, the standard table stakes function, right? So I do think you'll see that customer marketing continues to go up the maturity curve. It is still the smallest space right now, as evidenced by we're the largest vendor, you know, 30 people. But I think it's exciting. You know, tons of new technology, that there's the barriers to entry are just lowered these days with AI and the ability to quickly stand up a company. So, you know, it increases competition, which just, you know, increases the level and speed and pace of innovation, which is great.
That's indeed great. Yeah, it's interesting how you how do you think it evolves? The question at the end is also, is it about a VP of customer marketing, or is this more something that the whole organization starts to become much more serious about? Because it informs everybody. It informs not only marketing and sales and customer success, but also product strategy, for example.
That's a great point. Yeah, it is. And there's still... you still see all kinds of different setups, right? You see customer marketing as its own function. You see it as product marketing, part of brand. And depending on who they report to, you kind of get a very different playbook and manifestation. If you're reporting to corporate marketing and brand, you know, guess what? Like your stories are all going to be corporate marketing and brand oriented, right? If you're reporting more to product marketing, you're going to get a much more sales centric, you know, we're going to create a bunch of stuff that's actually useful to the sales reps. I like it going into product marketing personally. But yeah, I do hope that it gets to the point where it's kind of its own function that reports to the CMO. But yeah, to your point, like it is inherently a cross-functional oriented service function, right? You are creating content that, you know, arms product marketing, you know, it arms demand gen, marcom, PR, website, social, salespeople. So like the value of that function is directly tied to the value that they can produce for other functions, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah, it's true.
And everyone's involved too. It's like, you can't do your job as a customer marketer if you can't get access to customers, which is still a problem I see. It's like a sales or account manager, you can't talk to customers now. You know, there's a renewal coming up, there's an upsell, there's an issue, whatever it is, like not a good time, right? And so like the worst situation I see for customer marketers is when they don't have direct access and they have to go through an account team to like, hey, does anyone have any candidates that might be good for stores? And they just, you know, no one raises their hand, right? So I think that's like an obvious thing. It's like, you have to let customer marketing have direct access to customers, particularly when you have thousands of users, right? If you have a bottleneck in there, that's not good architecture. So yeah, other functions do have to participate and, you know, help facilitate an environment where customer marketing can succeed.
Exactly. So maybe you have to just forget about the word customer marketing. It's just embedded in the organization. Mm-hmm. It has its feeders everywhere.
Exactly.
Okay. We'll see how that evolves. I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect. I already mentioned that. This is, of course, about, you know, when you build something that customers find worth making a remark about, which is the whole philosophy around it, you know, kind of there's a flywheel starting. But how do you optimize for that in how you steer the company. What do you steer for in the organization that kind of pushes everybody to those limits to create something that customers start talking about and keep talking about?
I think it comes down first to you know, listening deeply to customers, right? I think oftentimes when we deal with customers, especially in customer marketing, which is like we have an agenda, right? Like we're trying to get something out of them. The one of the big problems that I see is like there's a very siloed approach to customer feedback collection and usage right now, depending on the function that's doing it. So for example, if product management wants feedback from customers, they're going to do a 57 question survey around, you know, with a bunch of Likert scale crap on what we could build better and how do you like these features and stuff like that. And if they did get, you know, a bunch of good stuff, they're like, oh, cool, great. People like the product. But that's never going to make its way into marketing. And analogously, like if you're trying to do a campaign in your marketers to get more reviews on a review site and you discover that, you know, customers are unhappy, you're like, all right, well, interesting. And doesn't matter to what I'm trying to do and whatever, that's discarded too. So,
yeah.
But it's the same motion. It's the same source. And so I when it's, these feedback exist in silos, like you get a bunch of deadweight loss because stuff that would have been really useful to another function is discarded because it didn't fit the purpose of the particular function that was running it. And then everyone does their own approach. So, you know, a customer gets touched 7 times, you know, in the course of 6 months, product management survey, go do GT reviews, do this NPS survey, do a user evidence survey. And there's an opportunity to create a more elegant customer experience, right? Where it's, hey, how are you doing? You know, are you happy or not? If you're not, let's send you down a path that's more, you know, how can we do better? How can we improve your experience? If you are happy, let's send you down a more advocacy oriented path where we build content, we get referrals, leave reviews on review sites.
Yeah.
And we need to democratize the access to this customer feedback across the company, right? Every function, product, sales, marketing, whatever, should be guided by the voice of the customer. But the collection should be somewhat agnostic to the purpose. Like, in other words, like, you don't know how or why someone else in your company might need insights or feedback from the customer, but you got to collect it because that person might need it later, right? So, yeah, we have this kind of vision of kind of, again, democratizing and centralizing the collection, but also just creating more access to customer voice, you know, across different functions of the company, which, you know, I think really gets everyone aligned to the customer.
Exactly. And also do it once rather than 5.
Yeah. Don't ping them 6 times, right? Yeah. And then throw away most of the data.
Exactly. Well, I like that. And I agree with that as well. So last question, based on your experience, working with various startups, large or smaller, but now kind of building your own one, what is, something that you've learned or would love to have learned earlier in that journey that you know now that you could share with other people?
I think it's gotten tougher. I invested in a bunch of companies maybe like 2 years ago, kind of like post-Zerp boom. what I didn't realize at the time was that like all my network was heavily concentrated in go-to-market. So I made like 5 go-to-market tool investments, right? And stuff that does whatever, AI for email and, you know, AI for this, but all this kind of, again, incremental gains on the go-to-market-y stuff. And most of those have since gone out of business because they just don't solve, you know, an important enough problem, right? The incremental gains we're seeing in go-to-market, it's like, it's hard to build a business around that unless like you're solving a fundamental problem. So I think the advice I try to give now to like founders is like early in that process, understand from customers if you're solving a like a tier 2, tier 1 problem and if they'll pay for it too. Like, I think we got lazy for a while in that we're like, ooh, product-led growth. Like, we're just going to get a bunch of users and then we'll figure out how to monetize anyway. And you lose the signal of like, will people pay for this? And you just delay the answer to that question after you've done a bunch of work. The approach that we use, like our first customers, I sold on like just a clickable like prototype that I built in Figma that wasn't working at all. It's just like a link of a bunch of screenshots taped together, essentially. It's like $30,000. Would you buy it? Yeah, great. All right, cool. Now that you bought it, we'll go figure out how to build it. But I do think that's important really is just like understand if there's a problem, like a problem that people would pay for. I also think that's like, we probably have an over concentration of talent and companies in go-to-market, which is why it's so noisy and so competitive. And it just, there's going to be a lot more churn there of companies that just don't make it, because I don't think it deserves to be that big of a category that merits that many companies. But the reason why there's so many companies is just because, like, it's easy to think of an idea in that space and the barrier to entry is so low. So like a lot of my core investments now, like I look at like, where are we solving more durable problems in like a world context? And that is like oftentimes like vertical software, right? The other thing that's cool about vertical software is like the spaces are often super behind. Like if you're selling to freaking mining or forest fire people or whatever, it's like they're not getting 27 emails a day like a tech marketer would, right? And so bringing some of this magic of SaaS and AI to them was like, holy crap, this is awesome. I try to look for more durable categories now. You know, one lens I use is like, hey, if there was mass famine and war, what would be the first to go? Well, it's probably my like, email optimization, go-to-market thing that generates more leads. But we're always going to need to figure out freaking food, climate, healthcare, supply chain, like those are all stuff that are going to be problems regardless. And so that has been a little bit of a world shift for me, where I've gotten perspective on just like kind of getting out of my bubble,
Fantastic advice. Completely agree with you. In my book, I'm talking about the triangle. The problem is, it's how valuable is it on a scale of 1 to 10? You want to be in the 8, 9, 10 range.
Yeah.
How critical is it on a scale of 1 to 10? Also, you want to be there at the scale of the 8 of 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. And then what is your ability to exceed an expectation? And again, you need to be high there as well. So at the end, it becomes a formula. But so many companies think, okay, yeah, well, I'm solving a valuable problem, but it's not critical, and therefore it's a nice to have. And especially when you then put in, okay, so now it's crisis time or it's war time, then it did immediately down the drain.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, I do think about that. It's like I'm not naive enough to say that like we're solving a meaningful problem or helping the world or anything like that. So next startup, I'll work on something a little bit more thorny for sure.
Yeah, but you're definitely solving a highly valuable and critical problem because it gets so hard. And the only way to get through the noise is through evidence that people believe.
I think like I'm an econ major, and so it's a market inefficiency problem, right? Like you have people that have great products, that have great customers, that can't acquire a new business because there's people that make bad products and have bad customer experience that just hide behind scale and marketing, right? And so information is the anecdote to that market inefficiency, right?
Well, thank you, Evan, for sharing all the wisdom. Time has flown by, my God. Where can people go to find out more about User Evidence or to say hi to you?
Yeah, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So Evan Huck, CEO of User Evidence. Hit me up on LinkedIn. If you're interested in User Evidence, userevidence.com, the website, or just send me a note, evan@userevidence.com. So
short and sweet and simple. Thanks. And this ends my conversation with Evan, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Evan Huck, co-founder and CEO of User Evidence. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in, and you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.